All right, so let's get started with the program. And the first event today is the keynote. It's a real pleasure and an honor to introduce Professor of Management at University of St. Andrews, Kirsty Ball, our first keynote. And, you know, there's really so many things to say about you and to mention about your legacy, I would say, in connection with surveillance studies and beyond. So I think I will just highlight a few things. First of all, you're the co-founder of the journal Surveillance and Society, which is still the main outlet for surveillance studies scholars, and also the co-founder of the Surveillance Studies Network, the organization which is central in the world today in surveillance studies, and the organizer of the big gatherings of surveillance studies scholars. And you're currently the director and co-founder of CRISP, the Center for Research into Information Surveillance and Privacy. And you're also the author of several really important reports that have had a significant impact both in the UK but also in a European context. So today you're really a leading scholar and authority in especially workplace surveillance, and I think your work has been a great inspiration to me and many other scholars over the years. So it's really a pleasure to give you the word now, and I'm looking very much forward to your talk.
Thank you, Anders. That was really moving. You've got a tissue. Thank you so much, and thanks everybody for coming, and thank you for inviting me to speak at this conference. After 25 years of thinking about the surveilled subject, it's brilliant to have an event devoted to some of the more agential aspects of being under surveillance. So I was thrilled at the prospect of the conference. I've really enjoyed it so far, and congratulations, both of you, for the organisation. So this talk is going to be partly me coughing once in a while, but also it's going to be a little bit of a primer on the surveilled subject, maybe recap some of the theoretical perspectives that we already have in our discipline. And then I'm going to look at some current developments from the workplace, particularly to think about how we might develop our thinking in this area. The workplace is one of those settings where we find surveillance shot through. And within the last 10 years, I think there's been more studies of the workplace in surveillance terms than there have been in the last 30. But it's typically a setting which is not necessarily the first port of call for a surveillance scholar. So I'm going to keep talking about it and tell you why it's all very interesting. So the surveilled subject then. Well, the first surveilled subject that we encounter as surveillance scholars is probably the panoptic subject. So the panoptic subject is a shadow. We can't see the face, we can't see the features, we can't see the expression. We can see bodily comportment in the panoptic subject, but this body is not supposed to do anything sudden or unpredictable. They're just supposed to sit there and think about themselves. So they're a little bit of a mysterious figure, but there's all sorts of things going on under the surface. Perhaps multiple struggles with normalizing judgment. And that's the interesting bit for us. So I'm going to talk about how it's possible to think about the surveilled subject a little bit differently. So maybe in terms of the multiple analytical layers that are beyond that shadowy outer shell and beyond the outline of the body. And we'll talk about how these internal layers are available to be read surveillantly and sometimes rebel against themselves. So I'm going to start with body sociology. I'm going to move through some phenomenology a little bit using some Merleau-Ponty. And then I'm going to look at the empirical research on the workplace and the current state of play with workplace surveillance research. I'm going to argue that there are phenomena within the layers of experience, the registers of subjectivity, that workplace surveillance highlights, and that these can build up a rich picture of surveilled subjectivity and progress our thinking about it. And in actual fact, the surveilled subject themselves may notice these phenomena in however fleeting a moment and notice their presence within surveillance assemblages. But we should also note that the presence and practice of surveillance has become more embedded, it's become more infrastructuralized, and therefore becomes a lot more difficult to notice, but we do notice it. We notice it in an embodied way. And so there are new ways needed to constitute the notion of embodied exposure to surveillance. So, allow me to just start my watch. I've just realized I haven't. Thank you. Right. So conceptualizing the surveilled subject then. When I started with this 20 years ago was I started to situate our thinking about the surveilled subject in sociological thinking about the body. And there are some key thinkers here, such as Catherine Hales, Nick Crossley, Elizabeth Gross. And I've referred to these before, and I'll just give a quick recap of these in a moment because these are our starting point. But there's another piece of work that I want to refer to, and that's Mark C. Taylor's book Hiding from 1999. Now, in the context of the surveilled subject, I have spent a lot of time thinking about skin. And I was initially thinking a few years ago that skin was a body surface where the interior is red and in that way is significant. I don't think that anymore. But what I want to do is start with this quote from Mark C. Taylor. And what he says is, the question of skin and bones is the question of hiding and seeking. And the question of hiding and seeking is the question of detection. Is detection any longer possible? Who is the detective? What is detected? Is there anything left to hide? And this is a series of questions that we might ask when considering the surveilled subject. So what of the interior can be read and understood by whom and why? And if the interior can be read, what is left as private and secret? So Mark C. Taylor here is talking about interior and exterior. He's talking about skin hiding bones, covering them, obscuring them from view. But in doing so, he's making a massive pun. And he's making a massive pun on the word hide. Because hides mean skins. Animal hides are the treated skins of animals. And they act in the common way that we refer to hides as animal hides as containers and barriers, protectors and shelters. But Taylor asks whether we are right to think about the skin as a barrier or a container. And when we read on, we find out that the skin, or the epidermis, has layers. It has four different layers. It's porous. It's not this solid boundary surface. It is one of the organs which mediate between the self and the world, enables that lived interior to be expressed and understood. But ultimately, it's a set of layers. So how might we extend this thinking to other aspects of the interior? Because the kind of surveillance that is being deployed now, we need to think differently, and that is what is needed in our thinking. So where do we start? So we start with that quality of connection between the lived body and the world, and that's the key concern of body sociology. So here were some of the foundational ideas that we start with, but they don't quite get to the idea of layers. So if we take, for example, Nick Crossley, who is a body sociologist, was at the University of Manchester, he says that he's very influenced by Merleau-Ponty. And what he argues is that rather than speak about the Cartesian dualism of the body, splitting the mind and body, he says actually we should be talking about the post-Cartesian body subject who has incorporated the world into the corporeal schema, the habits and experiences that emerged into the lived body as it goes about the world and it shapes its reactions and responses. So this is Nick's starting point. And what he says is this, and I find this really inspiring, this quote. He says, "We are never in complete possession of ourselves. Our perceptible being is captured in schemas of collective representation. Our anatomical state and embodied visibility are made to signify social meanings, and we, accordingly, are positioned in social space. We only come to have ourselves by first enjoining this intersubjective order and learning to see ourselves from the outside as other." So that is our starting point. Nick Crossley, he's saying that, you know, the way that we exist in the world, we have to see ourselves from the outside and inside. That's that reflexivity that Merleau-Ponty talks about is very much present in that quote. Now, many of us will also know the work of Catherine Hales, and she doesn't opt for this third term body subject. What she does is uses two simultaneous notions that have consequences for the embodied individual. She says that during interfaces with the social world, the embodied person becomes simultaneously inscripted and incorporated and comes into contact with inscription and incorporating practices. So incorporating practices, as we well know, are actions which become recorded in bodily memory, become habitual, such as dressing or walking a particular way. And that has great affinities with Crossley's corporeal schema. Inscription practices are different. These are actions which abstract information from the body, record it in other media, affording that information meaning by use of categories and social norms. So here we are approaching surveillance a little bit. There are characteristic ways of performing incorporating practices that are culturally specific, but these are corrected and regulated by inscription practices. So there's this constant tension in the way that Hales approach this, which governs how the lived body or embodied existence is performed. The final person I'll refer to is Elizabeth Gross. Now, she is concerned not only with tensions within the body as lived and a social object, which is the key distinction that Crossley talks about and Hales talks about. She's also concerned about how embodied persons as wholes interact with politics, history, technology, which lead them to be understood in particular ways. So she talks about instead, rather than the body subject or these tensions that Hales talks about, she refers to the body's inner and outer analytical surfaces and uses the figure of the Möbius band to show how they're joined together. And I was really interested to see on Vita's slide yesterday, you had a Möbius band as well on your slide. So hopefully we're on the same Möbius band thing. But the idea of the Möbius band is that there are these continual oscillations between inner and outer. So the embodied person themselves is an analytical monism interacting with others and with themselves. Okay, so we have this kind of oscillation, this interior oscillation, but we don't get to layers. So the thing that we need to do before then is then think about the connection with surveillance. Now, one of the problems that we have is that we don't always know when, where, how we may be being surveilled. We don't always act in relation to the presence of surveillance. And we don't act in the way that the panoptic subject is presumed to act. You know, they're subject to this glaring, normalizing judgment, a glaring, direct gaze, and accordingly adjust the behavior. But we do notice the gaze from time to time. It's not constantly there, but we notice it. Now, in 2009, I wrote about the concept of exposure, which is central to understanding this particular process. She says about her own work, but obviously there are other ways to approach it as well. But exposure occurs where the body's lived interior is captured on the outside by surveillant means. And I call this the political economy of interiority. And that moment of exposure where we're captured invokes all sorts of things at that moment: vulnerability, danger, thrill, empowerment, making oneself publicly visible, representation of yourself, capture of information. That's all sorts of things going on at that point. And the surveilled subject can be understood in terms of their relative exposure, the momentary capture of aspects of the self in surveillance systems. And these things inevitably are things which are of value. So consumption patterns and preferences, risky behaviour, productive moments, because these circulate in the political economy of interiority. But we still haven't dealt with what happens if we don't know that that's going on or we're not aware of it. We're still subject to surveillance, but we're not acting upon it as it is acting upon us. So the problem may be that when we think about surveilled subjectivity, we have thought about it traditionally in an action-oriented way. So what about the inactive surveilled subject? Where do we go with this idea? So Merleau-Ponty helps us again. So I don't know about you, but I have this feeling that every theorist that I like dies before they say the thing that I want them to say. So this happened with Foucault in Technologies of the Self, and it happened with Merleau-Ponty in The Visible and the Invisible. So The Visible and the Invisible is a book that was posthumously published, and it was kind of amalgamated from his writings by sort of other scholars. But in that book, he uses the notion of proximity to move away from this interaction-oriented notion of subjectivity. So this, the proximal subject is one which is perhaps anchored in the sensual world, the reflective world, rather than the kind of active world. So proximity can vary under surveillance. There can be immediate gazes that are very close to us, from customers or bosses, for example, from reviewers, but also more distal ones, more faceless ones, whose influence can be felt and acted upon in a number of different ways, places and times, away from that sort of immediate gaze. So Merleau-Ponty talks about subjectivity in these terms, and he says things like, when we have a relationship with the world, we develop a, quote, openness to the world, when we're not actively engaged or visible within it. And he calls this the proximal. He also says that, quote, we have an underlying mute relationship with the world that always already exists. And so because of that capacity to perceive, reflect, and then reflect upon one's reflections, that which is the hyper-reflexivity that Merleau-Ponty talks about, which is also a limitation of his analysis, he argues that objects as perceived by the subject are already overwritten with the body's perceptual capacity, so we have the capacity to notice these things as and when they arise. So these are, you know, progressive oscillations between the sensing body and the world, and he calls this a connection space or chiasm. And this is what he says about the chiasm. He doesn't really say very much about it, but this is the best sentence. He says it's a sort of straits between exterior horizons and interior horizons ever gaping open. And so establishes the idea of the embodied subject habitually sensing, incorporating, and constituting the world even when not interacting with specific things. So we don't always have to be directly interacting with a phenomenon for it to be acting upon us. It can be proximal and apparent, perhaps through norms about acting, which circulate. So as regards surveillance, as it becomes infrastructural, as it becomes less visible, we don't necessarily act as a direct result of its presence. And yet we run into it, we encounter it at many different moments and in many different registers. So these moments where we notice surveillance processes impacting on our lived experience, even if it is a fleeting moment, become really significant moments of connection as we realise our place in a much larger infrastructure and notice what's being expected, even if it's just for a split second, when we notice the power of surveillance. And it's helpful to think about it in this way, but it's also potentially confounding because Merleau-Ponty relies on reflexivity. He relies on reflection. And that depends what we're reflecting on and the diversity of responses to surveillance. So what I'm going to do now is take an empirical turn to look at studies of workplace surveillance to identify some of these different registers which may prompt reflection on surveillance. And I'm going to refer here to work which I recently completed for the European Commission, reviewing the state of research on workplace surveillance. So I'm going to switch slide and start talking about that. So the workplace then. Now, the current picture in the workplace is that a much wider range of technologies are being used which enable surveillance to extend beyond performance management. So we automatically think of, you know, the call center or the factory measuring outputs and performance, and into the thoughts, feelings, behaviors, location, movement, professional reputation of employees. And of course, this raises concerns. It raises concerns not only for intrusiveness and privacy, but also the equitable treatment of employees, their well-being, the boundaries of their work and private lives. And this is where they start to notice the consequences of surveillance. And the workplace is also at the forefront of developments in terms of where technologies are applied. I mean, it's a fairly enclosed environment, but also safety critical roles and post accidents, all those kind of things are where sometimes more surveillance is seen as a solution. So some of you might be aware of the work of Nina Farahani, who has recently spoken about neural surveillance and how employers are now interested in that. And sure enough, there's a sensationalist article in Harvard Business Review which talks about employers using neural surveillance and what they're doing with it. And all the tropes are there. It's there to prevent accidents. It's there to protect people from stress, stop people feeling vulnerable, all that stuff. And it does rather beg the question, is just design the work environment a bit differently in the first place and you won't have to stick electrodes on people. But here we go, right? So we have companies across the globe that have started to integrate neural interfaces into watches, headphones, earbuds, hard hats, caps, VR headsets for use in the workplace to do things like monitor fatigue, track attention, boost productivity, enhance safety, decrease stress, and create what they call a more responsive working environment, a little bit like the smart city discourse there. So this area of practice is called cognitive ergonomics, which makes the workplace safer, more adapted to employees' well-being. So the dry electrodes that are stuck in all of these things like earbuds and hard hats can pick up electrical brain activity to be visualized. And so this is very appealing in safety critical industries where attentiveness is important. So truck drivers, train drivers, pilots, that kind of thing. And in the article, there are examples of very serious accidents which maybe could have been prevented if the train driver had an electrode on his head or her head. So what this signals for us is how the deep interior surfaces of the body are being brought into the employment relationship. These are now contested terrain, as all employment relationships are. So we do now have to start thinking about these different subjective registers which are being extracted in the political economy of interiority. Now, I'm going to tell you now exactly what the latest research on workplace surveillance says. It demonstrates the different ways in which we can experience and notice surveillance. It does, I mean, people will read it differently, but that's how I read it. And these are multi-layered responses. So here's what we know. Okay, so the first thing that we know in the literature about workplace surveillance is that surveillance becomes controversial in the workplace when employees start to say, I'm perceiving this as increasingly invasive or authoritarian or excessive in some way. And the literature tells us there are three sets of factors which cause these perceptions. The first is your classic data protection kind of notion, the purpose of surveillance. If it's unclear, if it's absent, or if there's been function creep, if it's been exceeded. So that kind of set of factors can start employees thinking, actually, this is getting a little bit too much. Then we have aspects of management practice and the management of surveillance in the workplace. Either the policy isn't there to support it, the policy is not explained, people don't know their rights and remedies under a policy, and managers are not skilled enough to provide social support to those people who are monitored in the workplace. So are there other ways in which performance is talked about and work is talked about beyond monitoring? And the third set of factors is how the surveillance itself is configured. So we know, for example, that if there is too much focus on the individual plus their team, plus their department, if there's 360-degree surveillance, that is considered as felt as intrusive. If the surveillance goes into thoughts, feelings, behaviours, location, rather than simply performance, it's intrusive. If the person cannot control when the surveillance starts and stops, so for example, if they're wearing a body-worn camera that is always on, that is intrusive. And if they have no control over data sharing, that's also considered to be intrusive, so they don't know where the data are going and who is seeing it. And they feel quite familiar to us. They feel quite familiar to us as surveillance and privacy scholars. But here's some of the consequences that we know occur at the level of the worker. So we call these psychosocial risks in the kind of world that I live in. And on the left-hand side, what we can see is a ton of attitudinal changes. So we have attitudinal changes towards the sense of fairness in the workplace, justice in the workplace, job satisfaction, the amount of creativity expressed, the amount of commitment towards the organisation, to the team and to the task, the amount of autonomy people feel in terms of their responsiveness to these demands in the workplace, a decrease in trust and an increase in stress. And we also know that stress is not just an attitude, it's also an endocrinological reaction. And also the psychological contract, which if you've not studied your org behaviour or org studies or any of those things, a psychological contract is the set of expectations that govern how the employment contract is to be performed. So like goodwill, reciprocity, all of those things are a part of the psychological contract. At the bottom of that little hatched box there, you can see the words trait reactants. Trait reactants is a personality variable, and it refers to how certain people with high trait reactants have more of a tendency to react angrily to things which are morally or ethically dubious. So there's personality elements as well as attitudinal elements, hormonal elements, elements about expectations and social relationships. On the right-hand side of that box called psychosocial risks, we also see some of the more social impacts of excessive surveillance. Relationships become fraught. We feel the need to labour emotionally, so that's projecting a certain set of emotions outwards, feeling a completely different set of emotions inwards. The amount of identity work that we need to do changes, becomes more intense, so protecting our own identity while expressing another one. Public-private boundaries become compromised. We tend to see different values in the organisation based on control. And we also see an increase of resistance. And if you've ever studied employment relations, you'll know that there's a continuum. So the biggest measure, if you are an occupational psychologist, as to how happy or unhappy your workforce is whether they intend to quit or not. So this measure is called intention to quit. You can use it in any organisational setting and it will tell you whether your staff are happy or not. That's ITQ, it's called. But we also know there's humour, slacking, sabotage, these kind of informal resistant practices. And then public denunciation is a new one because there's now loads of different sites and blogs and stuff where people can really have a go at their employer, things like Glassdoor and things like that. And then, of course, our favourite, you know, collective action and strike action. So there's a real range of responses there. From right deep within the person to kind of within one's networks and political commitments. And to illustrate how these things look in practice, I'm going to read out from a couple of my most favourite papers. One of them is Madison Van Oort's Emotional Labour of Surveillance. I commend both of these to you. It's absolutely brilliant papers. And Andrew Manley and Sean Williams, we're not run on numbers, we're people, we're emotional people. And that's a classic organisational study, but we've got critical sociology as well. So I'm not going to tell you to close your eyes like Jazz did yesterday, because I'm not that dramatic in that way. But I'm going to talk to you about Madison's work, because she has conducted an ethnography of a fast fashion retail store. It was pseudonymed Spark. So in this store, we have fingerprint scanners used to clock in and to authorise access to the till. So here we go. Quote, during one of my first shifts at Spark, my manager Emily and I encountered numerous difficulties trying to register my information in the system. Two biometric scanners hung on a wall in between the break room seating area and staff lockers. After my manager punched a few buttons, the machine instructed me to place my finger on the scanning pad. No finger detected, the machine read. Try again, Emily told me, wiping the pad with a tissue. Still no finger detected. Maybe try a different finger, she advised. This time I used a different finger, but still no finger detected. Let's try this machine, she said, entering her employee ID number and successfully scanning her own finger on the machine next to us. I placed my finger on the second machine, attempting to apply more pressure, to no avail. Put like your whole finger on there, she said. Alas, still no finger detected. Go wash your hands, she instructed, annoyed, but not overly frustrated, as if she had encountered similar difficulties before. I scanned my finger once more after thoroughly washing my hands. The machine then displayed the following message. Error, no employee scheduled. To my confusion, but also relief, Emily told me, okay, that actually means it worked. You're in the system now, but since your schedule hasn't been put in, it says that error, but it does log when you clock in and out. So just do that like usual and we'll be able to pay you that way. After all that trouble, the error was apparently derived from my own sweat-induced anxiety. So what we have here is, for my purposes in this lecture, very helpfully, bodily layers, layers of experience working against each other. You know, she was flummoxed by the unpredictable reaction of her own body to the scanner. So the second extract I'm going to read is Andrew Manley and Sean Williams's 2019 paper. And this is about rugby players, so elite sports people. And the players' lives were run by data gathering on every aspect of their life. Video analytics of matches produced stats about work rates and performance. All kinds of biometric measures were taken, such as body fat, heart rate, and so on. The players were asked to do well-being scores, mood scores, and sleep scores. And this was displayed in an app, and the players' use of the app was monitored. So over the course of a year, the data from the app that they'd put in and the observations from coaches were amalgamated into a single number called the Work Efficiency Index. So this was really consequential for their playing careers. So the interviewer asks two of the players, do you feel you can escape the club now? And one of them says, who's called Phil, pseudonym Phil, probably less so. And I think this is with the speed of technology and apps and all this sort of thing, unless I lose Wi-Fi and then it's a dream. You know, my phone has gone here now a few times and I've been sat here, but if that's the phone going rugby, 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 whatever the message, whether it's watch an important video or you've left your boots, that's in your life, isn't it? It's there. It can't not be more in people's lives, in my opinion. And the second one, Alan, says they've got this new app. We've all been given iPads. So there's an app with every day's training on it, all the games, all the reviews from the week coming up, and they can see who's looked at it, who's been watching the clips, because they ask you to comment on stuff. I know a couple of boys get annoyed with it because it's all the time. Even when you go home from work, the boys are like, you know, you're in 8 till 5 and you get home and they send you messages like, look at this, I want to know tomorrow what's happening here. And the boys are like, oh, for God's sake. So we have there the public-private boundary being massively compromised. We have this constant presence of surveillance. And the rugby players resisted by resigning. Not just resigning, so one of them actually left altogether, but there was resignation, people keeping their head down. And one of the observations of the researchers was that instead of playing according to sort of a team rule, they played to the statistics. So in games, they were playing to make sure their work efficiency index was up and the statistics were correct about what they were doing. Moving now to talk about platform work, here the surveillance is much more infrastructural, much less legible. So people here build up tacit knowledge so that they can imagine, anticipate and negotiate the surveillance to which they're subject. And there's a whole body of work now on platform work, research, sorry. And what's particularly interesting for me is the idea of that what Chan and Humphreys call the algorithmic imaginary, which they observe in platform workers. And that has two dimensions. They first of all talk about the platform workers' anticipatory compliance with technology, so giving the algorithm what it wants. Tena Bucha has a great paper on upworkers called Pacifying the Algorithm. So when you look across the literature and work out exactly what this comprises, there's a real central tendency. So it's about not being too entrepreneurial while on the platform, being aware of the reasons why your account might get deactivated, not rocking the boat, not complaining publicly, don't use the help desk too much, don't speak to clients too much, don't show emotion, don't be angry, don't plead with the client for positive feedback, don't report too many problems. There's this real don't be too much of a person when you're trying to keep your account going on the kind of work platform. And delivery riders have been really well studied here. So they're well known to second guess the location of where they should pick up from, what's lucrative, and also to speak to management and learn from management about what they value. So that's the anticipatory compliance element. And then there's the normative control element. I did speak a little bit about this yesterday, but within platform workers, we know that they internalize ratings processes from customers, so the review processes, and they allocate discretionary effort towards customers who give good ratings. They don't even deal with the ones who give bad ratings. Galliere, who works on Deliveroo riders, finds that Deliveroo riders think of themselves in the same way that the platform thinks of itself. So identity work around being a high-tech entrepreneur, being in this meritocratic system. And Irani, talking about Mechanical Turk workers, actually comments that the true labour of platform work is hidden from the platform so that they project the right identity into the platform to continue working. And this strongly links to the surveillance capital argument of McCahill and Finn, which they use Bourdieu as a framing mechanism there. So that's some stuff on workplace surveillance. That's kind of a lot of what we know already. But I'm going to draw to a conclusion now and start concluding about my layers and thinking about these different registers of subjectivity to finish. So from looking at the workplace, we know that we are subject to surveillance and notice it in a lot of different ways. And here are just a few ideas on the slide. We notice there's electrochemical levels of engagement, endocrinological levels of engagement, behavioural, attitudinal, normative. We encounter it relationally, in relation to our creativity, in relation to our identities, our imaginaries, our boundaries, our emotions, our reputation, our morals, our sense of trust, in our sense of being seen and heard and having a voice. And some of my ideas from yesterday and around ontological security, in our sense of justice and fair treatment, and in relation to our rights as citizens, particularly around equitable treatment in the workplace. So there's just a few ways in which we may experience surveillance, and they're perhaps registers of experience where we find a connection space, where we may notice surveillance, where we may feel our proximity to its influences, where we can describe what it's like, what we think, and when we decide what to do next. We don't always experience surveillance as a glaring direct gaze, but we do notice it in different times and places. So, we began this discussion talking about skin and bones, and we're certainly surveilled beyond our skin, or our hides, as Taylor puts it. One of the things that's interesting here is that a multi-layered response or multi-layered experiences belies and obscures any singular sense of the lived body as a source of truth about the individual, which is what it used to be seen as. And then we wonder what kind of questions we're left with. We certainly have a sense of the interior of this mysterious, panoptic, shadowy whole. We have noticed that there are new ways to constitute exposure in proximal and time-stretched rather than interactional and specific ways. Many of the body's interior analytic surfaces are now surfaced and read from the outside, but they are also entangled with each other. The surveillance techniques which extract information from, for example, the nervous system, visualize the deep interior surfaces of the body, and they do so through computing power and algorithms, so what Dan Kotlier and Rafi Grossklick call the homo algorithmicus. But there are also those layers mediated by the flesh and the fluid which sometimes rebel. The body sociology literature has started to address the idea of rebellious bodies in the context of things like neurodivergent bodies, trans identities, celebrity culture, numerous works of fiction, film, certain medical conditions. So we have this idea of the rebellious body currently emerging in body sociology. But what's the rebellious surveilled body? Is this one where, far from being the surface of the site of resistance, as I previously argued, interplay between the layers and the transparency and transience of those layers are where the contestation occurs? So are we moving our thinking towards about the body to one which layers of experience are compliant with, resistance to, and rebel against each other and the proximal gaze? And what is controversial about the different commitments of the layers? So the theory arguments I set out at the beginning of this talk, although they were made and explored a while ago, are still significant and interesting and foundational in our thinking because of the ways in which the body interior can be read. But the layers themselves are another source of resistance, politicization, contestation, and debate. But it does rather raise the question of what happens if there's nothing but layers, if we become obsessed with layers. And I'm going to end on this quote by Mark Taylor in the book Hiding, going back to where I started. And what he says, and it's very dated, but I do like it. He says, "Peel away one layer and nothing appears. Nothing but another layer. As info teletechnology," that's the dated bit, "fast forwards, the play of surfaces, the rate of superficial production and reproduction reaches fever pitch as everything becomes obscure in its very transparency." The end. That's me. Thank you for listening.